Welcome to Forces of Fantasy, a podcast dedicated to all things Warhammer Fantasy and then some. I'm your host, Gert-Jan van Heugde, but since you probably can't pronounce that, I'll just go by my initials, GJ. Hello all you fine folks, and welcome to a new episode of the Forces of Fantasy podcast. We have a bit of a catching up to do, because last week I was away on holiday, so that's why there wasn't a podcast episode last week. But the news engine hasn't been idle, because we have gotten some Old World news last week, and even though I was away on holiday and I didn't have my recording equipment with me, I was still able to do a bit of a video review of last week's article, as well as for this week's article. So last week we got the movement phase. We got to take our first look at what is going to happen in the movement phase. And the big news is that we have a new type of formation called a marching column. Your formations can no longer be deeper than they are wide and still get into combat. Well, they can get attacked, but they cannot charge. You have a combat order where your formation is wider than it is deep, and a marching column order where your formation is deeper than it is wide. And if you are in the marching column order, then you can move up to 3 times your movement instead of up to 2 times when marching. Although then you have to reform, so I don't know how that is going to work. Maybe you can just add or reduce a rank and then still make a bit of a move in the next turn. But yeah, we will have to see how that will work. So in the movement phase, you get to first declare charges with the regular charge reaction and the reintroduction of an old one, the counter charge, which some units can do. Then you make your charge moves, and that is again as it was in 8th edition with a dice rolling principle. So it's not just double your movement, but there is a bit of a randomness about it, which can be a good thing, especially because there's pre-measuring allowed. But for me personally, I've never gotten the hang of that, and I always make the mistake of positioning my troops where I think they are out of charge range, and then just to have them charge the next turn, because you add, I believe it is 2d6 in 8th edition. It's been a while since I played it, so I'm not sure about that. I believe it's 2d6 plus your movement, though might be mistaken there. Then, after charge moves, it's time for compulsory moves, such as fanatics or trolls that failed a stupidity test. And then finally the remaining moves, where you can do the regular maneuvers, wheel, reform, turn, move backwards, move sideways, redress the ranks. The only thing that's new here is that a turn, you surrender a quarter of your movement for each 90 degrees you turn. So it's no longer that you can turn 180 degrees for a quarter of your movement and then move 2 inches and then turn back for a quarter of your movement. So basically move 2 inches backwards. But I think they've gotten special rules for that, such as move backwards or move sideways. We can probably do something like that at half pace. What says here at half pace? So that was last week's article, and then this week, this past Monday, we got the shooting phase, the Old World Almanac, the shooting phase. The big news here is that we do get our ballistic skill back. I had feared at first it was going to be like in Age of Sigmar, where you have a number with a plus. So if you have a 3+ for shooting, you just have to roll a 3+. But that's not the case. We do get ballistic skill. There is a bit of a change there in that if you have a high ballistic skill, it's no longer an automatic hit, but you get 2 numbers there. So for example, if you have your ballistic skill of 7, you had a first First one is a 2+, and the second one a 5+. That means that if you fail your first roll, you can re-roll, but it's a bit more difficult. So the re-roll is a 5+, and the first one is a 2+. And those numbers are modified by the things like moving and shooting or cover. We also get our first look at the 2-wound chart. There is a change there from what it was in earlier editions. In 8th edition, it was just basically everything hits on a 6+ or less. And then in the editions before that, there was a cap. So if you have a strength of 1 versus a toughness of 1, that's a 4+. If you have a strength of 1 versus a toughness of 2, that's a 5+. 3 and 4 is a 6+, and then it stops. But in the new edition in Warhammer the Old World, you have 2 more 6+s. So your strength 1 weapon can actually wound a toughness 6 creature. Strength 2 goes up to 7, strength 3 up to 8, strength 4 up to 9, and from strength 5 onwards you can hit everything, or you can wound everything I should say. We also get a new mechanic in that weapons have now a armor piercing property. I believe it's called armor piercing. The abbreviation is AP, armor penetration, I guess it is. So if you have a strength 3 longbow, it has no armor penetration, but your screaming skull catapult that has a strength 4 under the template and a strength 8 under the central hull, it has an armor penetration of -1 under for the whole template and -3 for the central hull. So the armor penetration is no longer just about the strength, and it doesn't say it stacks. I think it doesn't stack, so you don't have the strength 4 equals an automatic -1 to your armor save. Because in that case, the strength 8 would equal an automatic -5 to your armor save. What's also new in this edition is that in the shooting phase, wizards can cast their shooty spells. These are the magic missiles and the magical vortexes. We get two examples of these, the fireball and the vortex of chaos. I'm not going to discuss them in great detail because I do that in the YouTube videos I made earlier this week and last week. So if you want to know a bit more about that and my thoughts about these mechanics and how I expect they will work, then I suggest you head over to the Forces of Fantasy YouTube channel, which is simply youtube.com/@ForcesOfFantasy, and the at is the at symbol you also use in your emails. Or you can just simply click on the link that I will provide in the description for this podcast episode. We also have some more upcoming news. Not only do we get to expect a look at the combat phase next week, this weekend there's also going to be the Warhammer World Championships. And during these Warhammer World Championships, we will get some previews. Now, there are some different times here because I've seen several different adverts for this. One of them says it's at Saturday morning at 3 a.m. GMT. That would be 4 a.m. for me in Western European time or Central European time. I don't even know what time zone I'm in. Amsterdam time. And the other one, the advert that I'm looking at now, it's placed on the Warhammer the Old World Facebook page. That says it's at 2 a.m. GMT. So that will be 3 a.m. Either way, it's in the middle of the night for me. And on the Saturday, I've got things to do, as well as on Sunday, because on Sunday my oldest daughter is turning 4. So I don't know if I will have a lot of time to cover this preview. I will try to anyway to do that on the Saturday, probably also with another YouTube video. And I'm really looking forward to this one because in the ad I'm looking at on the Facebook page, it says 3 days to go, and the 3 is hewn out in a sandstone pillar with some hieroglyphs, and we see some scarabs and skeletal hands there as well. So I guess we will get our Tomb Kings preview, Tomb Kings reveals, the same way that we got the Bretonnia range reveal a few weeks ago. And as someone who has been playing Tomb Kings since they got their army book in 6th edition, I'm certainly looking forward to see which miniatures will return and also to see which new units will be introduced. So I'm definitely going to try to cover it as soon as possible on the YouTube channel, and you will hear it also on the next podcast episode if you're not into YouTube. Apart from this old world news, there's also a miniature that has been released for Age of Sigmar that might be of interest to some, although he is very situational, I guess. This is the Honorable Grand Justice Gourmain. And this Honorable Grand Justice Gourmain is a ghoul. You can use him as a ghoul king. And as the name suggests, he is dressed up as a judge. He's got a wig made of entrails. He's got a necklace with some hands hanging down from it. He's standing on some books. He's also got a book open. The very nice blotchy scratches in there. The books themselves, at least the books that are on the ground, they do look a little bit pristine, at least the way that they are painted for a ghoul king. But yeah, you can use this one as a Strigoi vampire. It is a very nice touch to make him into a judge. And I think that there are definitely some Vampire Counts players out there that can use this miniature. Another thing I'd like to mention is that there is a new podcast out there. This podcast is called Square Based, and it covers Warhammer the Old World, the Warhammer the Old World news that we've been getting. I haven't had a chance to listen to them yet, but I've heard some people who are very pleased with this podcast. So if the Old World is something that you're interested in, I suggest you give them a listen. And I wanted to give them a shout out anyway, so I hope that this will help them grow their customer base as well. Apart from news, I also have some hobby news. In the sense that even though I went away on holiday for a week, I did bring, for the first time in my life, some miniatures to paint. I had my second batch of 52 Goblin Spearmen, including a test model I did before. Well, no, not including, so excluding. But there was 53 goblins I took, 52 of them I wanted to paint. And I used an old fishing case. And this was actually my first miniature case. Back in the day when I started with Warhammer, I needed something to transport my miniatures. And my dad, he had this old fishing case lying on somewhere in the attic, which he then gifted to me. And this case is, it has two trays that fold out when you open it up, and then there's some room in the bottom. So I put the goblins themselves in the top tray and some of the paint pots as well, some other stuff in the second tray, and then the paint handles that I made that I use for my miniatures, I put them in the bottom. And when I was packing my stuff, I noticed I had about room for 8 different paints, which is not too much, but if you have 50 goblins and you use contrast paints, then that is more than enough. So I was thinking about which paints to pack, and in the end I decided to leave 2 of them at home, which were the blue and green that I use for the tassels. Only upon arriving I remembered that I also need the green for the goblin's skin. And since that's usually the place where I start, I now thought, well, maybe I should just wait until I'm back home, but then I thought that's just my own autistic self talking, and instead I just silenced my autistic version and went to work with the colors I had. So that was black and red for the tunics, yellow for the spear shafts. And then in the end, I didn't even get to the other colors that I brought along, such as the metallic that I did when I was back home. After these goblins, after finishing these goblins, and when I was talking about this, I remembered that I still needed to paint the eyes. But other than that, the goblins themselves are finished. I still need to do the shields, but before I start on those, I wanted to make some progress on my other two challenge pledges. So for the Call of the Crown, I have for this month a Banshee, which is a raid in 4th edition, a Necromancer, and let's see what's the other one, a White, so that's a basic white on foot. I'm going to use the 6th edition Graveguard Champion for that, or maybe the 4th edition Graveguard Champion, I don't know, but at least it's a it's a model that is very fitting for a white on foot with a hand weapon and shield. I started on those yesterday night, and I was surprised how quickly the Banshee was done. That was just a black undercoat, a grey dry brush, white dry brush, and then some details and another few dry brushes to get some color on the face and the hands and the sword as well. And for the other challenge, for the Tale of Fort Gamers, I'm doing a Flame Cannon this month and a Battle Standard Bearer. These miniatures, the work in progress of the goblins and the undead, the dwarves I haven't really done much on yet, just the armor, so that's not very interesting. But the work in progress pictures I put up on the Forces of Fantasy podcast community, the Facebook group. So if you want to take a look, as well as post your own pictures there, I want to see what your work in progress is, you can head over to Facebook and to the Forces of Fantasy podcast community. That is going to be it for the news and hobby section. It is now, of course, time to jump in our time machine when we are going to 1985, specifically June of 1985, because in June of 1985, a White Dwarf magazine got released, White Dwarf number 66, that contains more than enough material to fill a full episode, even when just focusing on the Warhammer stuff that's in there. If I could turn back time, don't dig my time machine. Don't dig my time machine. We are on our way to 1985, the year that Rome and Carthage finally signed a peace treaty. Officially, for 2100 years these ancient enemies had been at war, but in 1985, the two mayors of those cities signed a peace treaty, thus officially ending this war. But where one war ends, another war is free to begin. A war on the tabletop, that is, because in 1985, second edition of Warhammer Fantasy had been out for some time, and we get some White Dwarf attention for this. Now, the last White Dwarf we discussed on the show was White Dwarf 63, which contains some regiments of renown. But since these and more also appeared in the Citadel Journal Spring 1985, we didn't really pay too much attention to this issue. Between issue 63 and 66, the other two issues 64 and 65, they do contain some adverts. There's an advert for Warhammer 2nd Edition in White Dwarf 64. And there's an advert for the Citadel Journal, the Spring 85 Citadel Journal, in White Dwarf 65. Other than that, there's not much there for these new game system, for this new Warhammer 2nd edition, at least until we get to White Dwarf number 66. Because in White Dwarf 66, we have several articles. We get two more new regiments of renown. We also have an open box category. That's the review section, where we get a review for Warhammer 2nd edition by Robert Alcock. And we get a fan-made set of rules for playing ambushes. Let's start in chronological order, which is with the open box, the review. Mr. Alcock writes, "Physically, Warhammer 2 is a vast improvement upon the original, with three sizable rulebooks sporting full-color John Blanche artwork. Also included are color cutout figures to use in the Magnificent Sven scenario, a 12-page pullout in the Battlemagic book, and a very useful ready reference chart and order sheet. The rules themselves run to 150 pages split between Combat Battle Magic and Battle Bestiary books. Essentially, there are few changes from the first edition. However, certain major clarifications and expansions are now included, and they serve to make the new version somewhat indispensable. Notable additions are uses and effects of standards and musicians, and new rules for flying, fortifications, fire, artillery, chariots, reserve units, specialist magic users, point systems, and poisons. All of the characteristics of characters and monsters are now numerical rather than the odd mixture of letters and numbers previously in force. The three volumes are profusely illustrated with some very useful diagrams explaining how certain of the rules involving maneuvering actually work. The photographs of scenery look like they were cut out of a 1960s Donald Featherstone book. No idea who that is, I'm not British enough for that, I guess. But luckily, the poor quality of these are an exception rather than a rule. The development of the known world, which is the what later would become the Warhammer world, provides a useful anchorage for the wide variety of creatures and cultures. The world is based on our own, with certain modifications, rather reminiscent of an old FGU set of rules, Archworld. Aztecs have become Slan, and the Far East is called Cathay. Viking types, Arabs, and the Old World all have roughly historical backgrounds and troops. Warhammer 2 is a predictable expansion of the original, although it has not ironed out all of the problems. Personally, I do not like throwing a bucket full of dice to cause casualties and then find that your opponent gets most of them back with a saving throw. However, Warhammer does remain the only viable set of fantasy mass battle rules. The continued flippant attitude of the mainstream historical wargame establishment to fantasy gaming has made this so." Then Mr. Robert Alcock gives us his final assessment with some points, and these are taken as points out of 10. A 6 for complexity, a 7 for ease of use, a 6 for production, an 8 for value, and an 8 overall, which doesn't really add up as an average. I think the average should be a 7 based on these things, but well, overall the game gets an 8. Maybe interesting to note is that in this same open box section, there's also a review of Talisman. I have absolutely no experience with Talisman, and even though it is sort of Warhammer Fantasy adjacent, I'm not going to discuss it here on the podcast, at least for now. I might go back to it at some point in the future if Talisman is something that I can get into for some reason. But yeah, for now, this is going to be the open box review that I wanted to mention. Let's move on to the rules for ambush. This is an article written by D.P. O'Connor. And it starts us off with a little bit of a fluff piece, a little bit of an introduction. "Blasted weather," thought Captain Tell. This was the fourth patrol he had taken out in as many days, and the grey drizzle had soaked him and his men each time. He turned in his saddle and looked at the line of horsemen stretching out behind him, each one huddled into the sparse protection afforded by their capes as their mounts wearily picked away through the quagmire of the track. A week ago, an isolated homestead had been raided by a drow war party, and ever since his men had been put out on duty. "No doubt they'll have scarpered by now," he remarked to the corporal, who had drawn level.
"No doubt," mumbled the corporal in agreement.
Captain Tell sighed and rubbed a grimy hand over his face.
"We'll go as far as the next copse and then turn back. Tell them in."
His terse tone betrayed his weariness as he scanned the route ahead. The track ran down the side of the hill into a lane between two thick hedgerows, and then up to a small copse on the other side of the valley, not a mile away. He reined in his horse for a moment to allow half of his 12 troopers to pass, noting in each of them the same red-rimmed and grainy eyes. He entered the lane just as the front man was reaching the far end, and suddenly he felt the hairs on the nape of his neck bristle. At that moment, a volley of arrows whistled out of the hedgerow into the unprotected right side of his men, sending three of them tumbling to the ground immediately, and turning the lane into a screaming confusion of bucking horses and shouting men. Seconds later, the hedges erupted with drow bursting from every bush, eager to take advantage of the confusion and to win an easy victory. Captain Tell drew his sword and wheeled his horse in one swift movement.
"Ambush! Ambush!" he cried, hoping that his men would hear him and respond to the drills that he had taught them.
Two of them, he noticed, had already spurred their horses out of the trap, while another was being pulled off his horse.
"Ambush! Ambush!" he called once more,
and then spurred his horse directly at the hedgerows from which the enemy had emerged. Clearing the hedge in one mighty leap, he galloped on for 20 or 30 yards before looking back. Good, he thought. At least the corporal and yeoman Fletcher had escaped.
"How many did we lose?"
gasped the corporal as they spurred their horses on at a gallop.
"I saw Thompson and Crabtree get out," said Fletcher, equally breathless. "And I think I cut one of those drow pretty bad."
"I saw three go down with the first volley and another go down after that. Old Toby and Willem for sure, but I couldn't see who the others were," replied the captain.
"Ought we not to go back and see if the rest are all right?" asked the yeoman.
"Not likely," said Captain Tell. "If they get out, they know where the camp is. If not, well, that's just tough," he thought.
This is either saying something about the captain or about how fierce dark elves are in this edition, or at least in his eyes. You get ambushed, you get out, and that's it. And I think that's also what the writer for this article, what Mr. O'Connor was going for. So he says in his introduction that the ambush is perhaps the most exciting encounter in fantasy roleplay. However, for Warhammer players, it's also the most difficult to simulate. Actually, setting up an ambush on the tabletop under normal circumstances is simply a waste of time, because the opposing player can see the models attempting to hide behind walls and under piles of lichen. He's hardly likely to move his forces tamely into the pit dug for them in the middle of the road. And if the models are marked on the GM's map only to be placed when the enemy strays into the area, the opposing player will immediately smell a rat and take evasive action. There's of course also a way to play this while, even though you as a player know that there's an ambush coming, that you still play it as if your troops don't know it, but that is not an option in this article. So what he suggests is that you mess around a bit with the turn sequence and you use ambushes in a campaign setting. The best format for a campaign is for two opposing players and the GM to each have a map upon which to record their movements and their forces. The GM will, of course, have the dispositions of each side recorded on this map along with the encounters he has prepared. This system, in effect, means that both players are blind as to their opponent's whereabouts and must, therefore,
carry out reconnaissance and to ascertain the enemy's strength and disposition. This, in turn, leads to the necessity of small units being dispatched ahead of the main army to look for the enemy. Should the opposing player wish to keep his position secret, then he must prevent the enemy from carrying out reconnaissance of his position. The best way to do this is by ambushing the enemy's scouts. To prepare an ambush, the ambusher, player A for convenience, must first move his force to the desired area and then notify in secret his intention to stage an ambush on any enemy that happened to chance that way. The GM then marks the position and strength of the ambush on his map for future reference. When an enemy strays within range of the ambush, the action is transferred to the tabletop. However, the victim, player B, does not automatically take control of his troops. Instead, the GM controls them. This prevents player B getting smart and avoiding the ambush altogether or ambushing the ambushers. The GM will then move player B's force along the course that they were heading until they enter the ambush. At this point, it is necessary to suspend the normal turn sequence. This is entirely at the option of player A. He may prefer to keep the normal turn sequence. He may spring his ambush at any time during his opponent's movement phase. The result of this is to cancel the rest of player B's turn, which means that he has no shooting, hand-to-hand combat reserves, magic or rally phase. It also cancels all of player B's remaining movement. Player A springs his ambush by simply declaring ambush. He then begins his turn with the shooting phase, followed by movement, hand-to-hand combat, reserves, magic and rallying phases. On player B's next turn, the sequence returns to normal. Player A also receives two more advantages from his ambush. Firstly, he may retreat his troops a half move during the reserves phase. However, if he does take advantage of this rule, then he cannot subsequently turn his troops round on the next move. This represents the hit and run aspect of the ambush. Secondly, on the first round of combat, player B's forces weapon skill is reduced to 1 to represent the surprise and the time taken to draw weapons, etc. I think those are both very good rules to add as well. So what then is player B doing while his prized troops are being cut to pieces under control of the GM? On each move at the start, preferably, player B rolls 2d6. If he scores equal to the troop's intelligence minus 1 or less twice, then he may regain control of his troops. For example, the GM declares an ambush to be imminent and the troops are placed on the table. Player B then rolls 2d6 and scores a 7. His troops are elves and their intelligence is 9, so this roll counts as a successful roll. On the next move, he rolls 12, a failure. But on the next move, he rolls 5. He has now successfully rolled intelligence minus 1 twice and may regain control of his troops. This represents Captain Stell's bristling hairs, the instinct that something is going to happen. Player B may then proceed as he sees fit, either to attack the ambushers, in which case the battle takes place along normal lines, or to simply withdraw. If, however, player B does not succeed in rolling his intelligence, and note that this is the troop's intelligence minus 1 that is rolled, not the leader's or character's, and he blunders straight into the ambush, then the following procedures should be followed. 1. Player A completes his turn. 2. Player B rolls his leadership or less. If successful, he may move his troops as he wishes. If unsuccessful, he must roll his cool or less. If this roll is successful, then they will react according to their drill, and that's something that we'll get to in a minute. If unsuccessful, they will move in a manner determined by rolling 2d6 and referring to the diagram given for the ball and chain. That's a random movement, a bit of a scatter type, where you use the clock phase. We discussed this in an earlier episode. This process is repeated on player B's next turn. On subsequent turns, he regains control of his troops. Missile troops will fire according to their drill or not at all. What is this drill that has been mentioned? Most armies have set procedures to deal with situations on which there is no time to give detailed orders. The reaction to an ambush is the classic case. A drill movement should be simple enough to allow it to be carried out without thinking and should consist of two parts. firstly the immediate reaction, and secondly the collective action. The first part refers to the individual's task, and the second refers to the regrouping of the unit and possible retaliation. However these drills are formulated, they must be submitted to the GM at the beginning of the campaign, and should remain constant throughout. Drills may be changed at the GM's discretion, but I would recommend that the number of times that they are changed be limited, on the grounds that it is difficult for troops to adjust to new ways. Troops with low intelligence should never be allowed to change their drill, as they have difficulty remembering it anyway. Then we get to a section for some drills and tactics, where, I think that this is something that I will just sort of glance over. We get some suggestions for how to deploy your troops for the deployment of an ambush group with archers and missiles at the front and then the attack group behind. And then he says that the first part is the archers firing at close range into the enemy. Then in the movement phase, the attack group moves through the missile group to engage hand-to-hand combat. This requires a rather liberal interpretation of the interpenetration rules, but I feel that if skirmishers can move through a regular formation, the reverse is also possible. So that's basically a house rule, but then again, this entire article is house rule, so I guess that doesn't really matter much. At the same time as that the attack group moves in, then you have two flanking groups on either side. They should be there to prevent the enemy from escaping. They should not, however, attempt to encircle the enemy, as this allows them to run away, and if higher than the melee, allows the missile troops to shoot at the fleeing rebel. And then you also have some rear guards. They have two services. Firstly, they are armed with missile weapons, so they can pick off any enemy who decides to charge through the ambush. And secondly, they provide a first line of defense should they be attacked from the rear. Then there's also a bit for the units that are being ambushed. Here you have a column with an advance guard, a center, and a rear guard. And the idea here is that the advance guard and the center as well try to push through the ambushers and try to get away. While the rear guard is basically being sacrificed, so that's the troops that they are not going to return for. Or you can just use all three of these blocks to make a last stand, or to try to break out at the same time to attack the ambushers. If ever I get around to playing the Magnificent Sven scenario, if I ever get enough Lizardmen painted up as proxies for the Slan and everything, and the characters, then I think I will follow the suggestions in this article, where you have two player maps where the players give directions for which forces move where, and then the GM is just going to keep track of what happens on which turn. Of course, this would probably be a solo play unless we can get some people together who to do this online. And then at some point there will be a battle fought, and that will last for a number of turns, and during which, after the battle, we will basically go back to the point when the battle started, keep track of the number of turns, and then after the battle has resolved, then the remaining troops can again move and do the things that they would in the normal campaign section. That way we don't need a, what did I say it was, 13 foot by 8 foot floor area filled with terrain to basically move all the units at the same time. And we can just play the game on the map and then fight the actual battles on the tabletop. That's also what the writer of this, D.P. O'Connor, suggests. Next, in White Dwarf 66, we get two new regiments of renown. Although, I say in White Dwarf 66, but these two regiments of renown, they were not in my PDF copy of White Dwarf 66, because they were in a separate insert, a separate rules insert, that was included with the White Dwarf 66. Sadly, I don't have a physical copy of this White Dwarf, so I don't have a physical copy of the insert as well. But there is a great website out there called Stuff of Legends, solegends.com, where you can find not only all the Citadel catalog pages and the Citadel compendiums and everything, but also these rules insert for the Regiments of Renown from White Dwarf 66. These are photographs of the pages, and as such they are a bit blurry, but I will attempt to do my best at reading them out for the podcast here. The first new Regiment of Renown we get are the Disciples of the Red Redemption. The Red Redemption was born during the bitter religious wars fought between the Men of the West and the swarthy Arabians. Amongst the countless factions of crusading warriors, those known only as the Brotherhood were surely the most feared and the most powerful. As with all protracted wars, there were long periods of inactivity, while supplies were organized, spies sent out, or paltry scouting missions undertaken. Such lulls were anathema to the more zealous of the warrior priests of the Brotherhood. They hated sitting around whilst they knew the Arabians were out there being, well, downright Arabian. Eronius Belbedron was one such frustrated fanatic. Eronius fell into a black mood whenever the fighting got held up. And then there's a word that I can't quite make out. It reads a bit like steppy or stoppy, but I guess that's... Let's just read it as stop, because it refers to the holding up of the fighting. Each stop caused his moods to become even blacker. Indeed, legend has it that his skin and hair turned completely black during this time. His frustration turned easily to anger, and the anger grew inside him until it was almost a palpable thing. He sought solace in the holy books of the Brotherhood, but to no avail. His anger grew and grew until he became crazed and twisted with it. His hatred of Arabians became a hatred for all. Presently, a strange thing happened that was to change the course of Eronius' life, and the lives of countless others also. It was a dark evening, and the Brotherhood has just captured the ruins of an ancient temple from a group of Arabians. The enemy has hardly put up any resistance, and the fight has been a most disappointing affair. It was as he searched the ruins for any signs of the enemy that Eronius saw a curious book, its cover barely visible as it lay on the floor. Eronius compulsively picked it up and sought secrecy in the ruined remains of a sunken room. Eronius placed his torch in a bracket by the wall and feverishly spread the book in front of him. Kneeling before it, he began to read. To say that what he read was a bombshell would understate the impact of the volume that the volume had on him. In truth, his crazed mind could not at first believe that it was possible this aged book contained the truth. Eronius was overwhelmed by a feeling of physical, spiritual, and mental redemption. The book was a sacred scripture dedicated to and revering the chaos god of Khorne. Khorne, the black god of battle, the dark lord of slaughter, the thirsting god of blood. At once Eronius felt his links with the Brotherhood and with humanity permanently broken. In a fever of ecstasy, he pounded his face against the chamber walls until all that remained was, well, little enough remained to betray the fact that he had once been human. Only then did he see the black robes and iron masks that hung upon the chamber walls. The iron mask was unnaturally hot and seared his face as he put it on. The black robes soaked the blood from the armor. Aronius had become the first and greatest of the redemptionists, the master of redemption, and his cry was, "Be redeemed through blood, saved through slaughter." Quickly slaying his former comrades in a chaotic commando-style exercise of carnage, Aronius fled into the world at large. His objectives were unclear, but he was certain that people of the right persuasion would be sure to welcome enlightenment. He was right. Only a few years after the incident of the brother slaying, the cult of the Red Redemption had become established throughout the Old World. In the secret temples of the cult, initiates were introduced to the vile and bloody ways of the mighty god Khorne. The skin was ritually flayed from the face and torso of each initiate. Glowing hot iron face masks and cuirasses formed a new and tougher skin. At last, they were permitted to wear the black robes of Khorne. Of course, this resulted in all of the disciples of the Red Redemption suffering from total and irrevocable madness, but that really didn't bother them too much. They were more concerned in the shedding of blood of heretics as members of the countless groups of disciples than spreading the ways of Khorne into the world. One such group was Darkhold's Disciples of the Red Redemption. Darkhold was said to have been initiated by the Master of Redemption himself, a great honor indeed. His power was such that he could command a group of up to 40 disciples. The key to this power was the large black book that he always carried, the Darkhold. This was a transcript of the original scriptive book discovered by Aronius. It was a very powerful magic item, although its uses are confined to cult practices. Merely looking at the pages of this book would drive any living being insane. The disciples are immune to this by dint of them already having achieved this particular state of mind. Darkhold was able to read the passages from this book, and therein lies his power. A passage read from the book gives Darkhold the absolute power over the disciples, over any disciples that hear him. During the initiation ceremony, Darkhold would read a special passage from the book which so assaulted the mind of the initiates that his personality would be forever shattered. Darkhold would access this would assess the suitability of the initiate for cult membership by his reaction. If the initiate reacted with extreme violence, this was judged to be good, and he would be prepared for flaying and encasement in glowing iron. If the initiate failed to react with sufficient violence, he would be given up as a sacrifice to Khorne. Oh well, lovely fellow. These are, I guess, what you might even call the first version of what later became the Empire of Flagellants. They carry a flail, shield and mace, mail armor, but Darkhold himself, rather than a shield, he carries an additional hand weapon. The battle cry is "Be redeemed through blood." Deeds spreading the ways of Khorne through the Old World by means of slaughter, destruction, arson, murder, and the propagation of insanity. So, Chaos Cultists that we have here, specifically Chaos Cultists dedicated to Khorne. This, maybe this is not the first mention of Khorne, but it is one of the first indeed, because, the Realm of Chaos books have not been out yet, and Chaos is not yet as established as it will be in later eras. So, a group of Chaos Cultists, and that would be fun to field, although, sadly, I don't really see any special rules for them to represent their insanity. There's no mention of things like frenzy or something, or of this hold that the Darkhold has over his disciples. Then we get another new Dogs of War unit, another new Regiment of Renown. They're not called Dogs of War yet, Regiment of Renown. This is the Avenging Knights of the Cleansing Flame. It starts with a quote from Cronus Goodheart at the funeral pyre of the Brotherhood. From the ashes of the old are born the new, and the fire shall have cleansed them, and they shall be free of evil. Cronus Goodheart was a member of a singular band of crusaders in the Holy War against the Arabians. He was one of the Brotherhood. Cronus came from a deeply religious family and firmly believed in the ways of the West. He abhorred the swarthy, outlandish men of Araby and their insidiously evil culture. Now he was confronted by the most hideous scene he could possibly have envisioned. Before him was a sight that turned his stomach, and a stench that appalled both his nostrils and his soul. It was a human carrion. Carrion that had once been friend and fellow crusader. Cronus and his three companions were puzzled and horrified at the sickening carnage that had fallen upon their fellows. It was the work of no sane man at least, they reasoned. They built a great funeral pyre to consume what remained of the Knights of the Brotherhood. As the flames bellowed and roared, one of Cronus's knights made a strange discovery among the ruins where the massacre had taken place. Returning to Cronus, he told of his find, and Cronus at once investigated. What the young knight had chanced upon was an underground sanctuary, originally part of a temple, but now hidden amongst the ruins. Entering inside, Cronus saw blood-stained frescoes that depicted scenes of horror and perversion of an altogether abhuman nature. Worst of all, upon the floor lay the discarded uniform and the equipment of a knight of the Brotherhood. Erroneous, he gasped, as he recognized the clothing of one of the company, Erroneous Belbedron, his own cousin. Cronus's mind was thrown into chaos. Clearly his cousin had been murdered, and in a manner both foul and inhuman. The whole thing stank of some perverse religious ritual, of a terrible sacrifice to who knows what hellish god. But it was Garland, the standard-bearer, who glimpsed the truth, for in his youth he had seen the secret woodland temples of the Chaos Gods, and he had heard rumors of their deeds. He came from the forests of the Empire, lands deep enough and dark enough to hide the minions of Chaos and their victims. In the ruins of the temple, he recognized the signs. Cronus was struck dumb at what Garland told him, to find that his own cousin was the monster that had undoubtedly precipitated, if not actually accomplished, the deaths of so many good knights, was a considerable blow. The knights packed their sanctuary with straw, and around the whole circuit of the hill, they spread such flammable materials as lay to hand. Within an hour, the whole hilltop was on fire, and what little remained of the Knights of the Brotherhood and of the strange temple was utterly destroyed. As the flames burned, each knight swore a great and binding oath. This shall be our call to arms and symbol, the flame of our burning brothers. We must keep the flame burning until such time as our oath is fulfilled and the world cleansed of the evil of chaos. Only then can our souls rest in peace. And the flame we shall bear as our device, and the minions of chaos will come to fear us, and we shall be known as the Avenging Knights of the Cleansing Flame. So it was that the four knights travelled abroad in search of Erroneous. They encountered much evidence of his passing, and many men joined them in their quest, for many were the unspeakable acts committed by the defilers of chaos. The battle cry for these Knights of the Avenging Flame, or the Avenging Knights of the Cleansing Flame, is cleanse them and they shall be free of evil. As for their deeds, the knights continue in their quest, never ceasing or stopping in one place long enough save to eat or rest. So we have a band of traveling knights. Again, no special rules. These do have special rules. Their special rules are that Roland, which is the regimental's champion, his sword has a flame attack, and the sacred brazier carried by Garland, the standard bearer, is a powerful reminder to the knights of their oath. Whilst it remains intact, the whole unit may add +2 to their cool. The knights hate chaos worshippers, and when confronted by Red Redemptionist, they get +2 to their dice when testing. Did I then maybe miss the special rules for the other ones, for the Disciples of the Red Redemption? No, they really don't have any special rules written there. It just gives a further description of the shield and the uniforms, but that's also for the Knights of the Cleansing Flame. So, there we have it. Two new regiments of renown, very much tied in together. Two sides of the same coin, two different split-offs of the Brotherhood. And I think that it would be a great matchup to see these on the table and to devise a story around them. I also like how they tied this in to a section of Warhammer history that we've heard mentioned but hasn't been really explored very much, which is the Crusades against Araby. Of course, in later editions, this is something that will be developed a bit further, where you have specifically Bretonnia, who are fighting against the evil vizier Jafar from Araby. And this is also how many knights end up in the Border Princes, because some knights, they go overland and they arrive in the Border Princes and then they settle there. Very reminiscent, of course, of what happened with the real-world Crusades when the Muslim forces tried to invade Europe, and when they bothered pilgrims that were going to Jerusalem, to the Holy Land. It was then that the Catholic Church decided it was time for some retaliative action. The First Crusade, it started in 1096 and lasted for a few years, for 3 years, although there are some other end dates and start dates depending on who you ask. During this First Crusade, the Crusader states were founded, and they were then later lost again to the Muslims, and then several later crusades proved much less fruitful. This is, of course, just talking from a political perspective. I know there's a lot of things to do about the crusades, and that even some modern day Arabs or Muslims still refer to Christians or Westerners in general as crusaders because of some atrocities that have happened on both sides in the war, just as what we see happening in wars nowadays. So that's of course a lot of history there that has repeated itself over and over again, both in a religious and a secular context. Now, of course, this is not a very politically correct opinion, but then again, I'm not known as a very politically correct person. Political correctness is something that happens to other people. However, this is not a history or a religion podcast. This is a podcast about Warhammer, and only where the Warhammer history ties in to real-world history, which it obviously does, I feel the need to comment upon such matters. With this little look at the Crusades and the two regiments of renown that have arisen from the Crusades in the Warhammer version of them, it is time to end this episode. As far as Warhammer goes, White Dwarf 66 is a rare oasis in the barren desert of lots of other role-playing games, except Warhammer. I'm sure that many of these role-playing games are very interesting in their own regard, and I think that there's a lot of stuff here to unpack in these White Dwarfs if you're interested in role-playing games in general. I've seen some scenarios and some things that I think can be incorporated into modern-day role-playing games and into modern-day Warhammer games even, if you take a bit of trouble to convert them and to use the stats or the rules and apply them to modern day game systems. So not to dish on White Dwarf or anything. It's a marvelous magazine, especially if you are looking for a nice nostalgic kick here. However, this podcast is dedicated to Warhammer Fantasy, mostly Warhammer Fantasy. So that's the main interest. Next time, we are going to take a look at the first of the scenario packs, the first of the campaign packs that were released for 2nd edition. That is the Bloodbath at Orc's Drift. Probably I will also, after that, we again have to skip a couple of White Dwarf issues. Because in White Dwarf 68, that's the next one, there we will get another Regiment of Renown introduced, Isa Yuzgot's Mother Crushers, and we also get an open box review of Bloodbath at Orc's Drift. And I think that these will be two separate episodes, depending on how much time it's going to take to go through the Bloodbath at Orc's Drift expansion pack and the scenario, which in itself might even take up multiple episodes. I'm not sure about that yet. I haven't had a chance to study up on how extensive the rules are for this expansion pack. For now, I'm going to leave you with this. Thank you very much for listening, and I will catch you on the next episode. Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, you can reach me by email at forcesoffantasy@gmail.com. Go to forcesoffantasy.com for all news and updates. Come check out our awesome Facebook group, the Forces of Fantasy podcast community, and while you're there, give the Forces of Fantasy Facebook page a like. You can also subscribe to the Forces of Fantasy YouTube channel, where you'll find battle reports, playthroughs and more. Finally, if you like the show and you wish to support it, head on over to patreon.com/forcesoffantasy. There you'll find exclusive bonus content.